Welcome back once again to the Parish of the Patriots. This is looks like it's the 339th time. We've done this and we managed to keep it somewhat fresh. I like to think we keep it somewhat fresh. I'm glad you could join us this weekend. This episode, this installment is fresh. This is no day old bread. This is fresh because I'm recording this the morning of. It's going to be airing here in a matter of hours. Normally, I get it recorded a few days beforehand because the nature of the show, I can do that. We don't do news articles and stuff like that on this in this show. Normally, I get it done over the weekend, but I've been really, really, really busy and haven't had a chance. So we're doing this the day of. It's extra fresh. It's like getting fresh bread from the bakery. It's like going to the Vietnamese donut shop and you get those fresh donuts. They just made them suckers. It's still hot. Versus going to the grocery store and getting them donuts made with who knows what, because they've been sitting in that box for like 2 weeks. You wondering how they survive in there. Who knows what? You're not getting donuts, you're getting something else. We're getting fresh donuts here at the Parish of the Patriots. And we also, if you're new, I know most of y'all return listeners. If you're new, we do have a Christian specific segment. That's roughly the midway point of the show. So, something to look forward to. I will say, if you're unfamiliar, it is geared towards people who are already believers, and most of the time, honestly, I assume fairly well along in that pursuit of the faith and knowledge and truth and wisdom of Jesus Christ. So if you're not a believer or you're just a brand new believer, you may or may not get something out of it. You may listen to that and be like, man, I don't get any of that, and to just roll with that, because it is geared towards people who already are. If we had to sit there and have a discussion over just basic stuff, then people who are further along in their faith, they're not going to get anything out of it because we're having to stay back here. It's like being in a classroom. If you're in a classroom and like 90% of the classroom are like super smart, but they have the teacher has to hold everything back to that 10% that isn't as far along. Sounds like I'm insulting people. I'm not. Anyway, it is geared for that. But give it a shot. You may get something out. If you do get something out of the show, don't be shy to pay those tithes. We have the snail mail. If you look here on the description page for the show, if you look down at the bottom, we got a snail mail. You can put something in there. If you get something out of it and you say, man, that was really cool. That was really worth it. You drop something in there. You can drop an envelope. It'll be appreciated. This is the part where I go into the listener supporter mailbag. But once again, this is the part where I don't have no listener supporter mailbag because ain't nobody dropped nothing in the mail. But that's all right. That just means we can keep on rolling. So have you noticed you can't escape the constant lies. You know, you have all these, they're having a harder and harder time keeping people locked in and buying into the system because it's so absurd at this point. Only the lower and lower IQ people are still buying into the system. People who are in denial still buying into the system. They come out like you have the different political party, like in the UK, for instance, and they're going to do something about immigration. But they don't. They don't. And you look back, because they count on people having the attention span of like 5 minutes. So they just assume, they go to the next thing and assume you're not going to remember what they said yesterday, much less a couple years ago. But we remember, don't we? Remember when Angela Merkel said that they had to bring in all the immigrants because somebody was going to pay the pensions? You remember that ridiculous line? How many times have the Tories in the UK said they're going to do something about immigration? Well, they do something, all right. They bring more of them in. Because it's a part of their values of who they are in a democracy. Have you noticed, though, one of the lies that really sticks out at me? They look and they say, this country, country A, B, C, they have demographic decline. They themselves are what have brought the demographic decline on, or at least they've played a role in that. They never mention that. They act like it's something that just naturally occurs. It's like, well, we didn't have that before. And they tell you this demographic decline is always, it's always framed as a negative thing. I think a very good argument could be made that it is not a negative thing. In fact, it's just a cyclical thing to a certain extent. I realize that a lot of the demographic decline is related to liberal agendas, feminism particularly, and a lot of the other. I know that. What I'm saying is even that wouldn't matter in the long run. But it's always framed. It's, if you got demographic decline, the GDP line may go down. That's why we got to bring in more immigrants. You see, we got to just bring in some more units. This is also telling about how they view the people, isn't it? It doesn't matter if you're a fifth generation American. You can just as easily be replaced by a first generation Haitian or Somali. They view you as just units. You're not even human with your own cultures, values, thoughts, none of that. You're just blocks, or you might as well just be a brick or something. Another brick in the wall. You'd be another brick in the wall. They don't care. Just put another brick in there. Just a body. But they lie. This isn't an innocent mistake and they think they're doing the right thing. They're just misinformed because they blatantly lie about these things. One of the most blatant parts of this lie, every time you look at it, is they said in multiple instances years ago, Germany is a great example of it. But you do the same in the UK. We have demographic decline. And there's such a labor shortage. None of these countries, by the way, were ever at zero unemployment, and yet they claim to have a labor shortage. So we have to bring these immigrants in. And of course, the immigrants they bring in, by and large, are illiterate for the most part, and it doesn't matter. Well, you fast forward to today, and these countries, their economies are shit. They have high unemployment. They're shutting down industries, in Europe especially, or the UK, they're shutting down industries. The economies are failing. And what? They're still bringing in more immigrants, aren't they? You see, if the economy is doing great, more immigrants. If the economy is shit, more immigrants. If you have low unemployment, more immigrants. If you have high, you're starting to see how this works. Heads, you get more immigrants. Tails, you need more immigrants. It's their answer for everything. You see it everywhere. Germany. UK, their economies are shit, more immigrants. And now Japan, which has held out, they held out for a long time. But anybody with any insight or any able to look at the big pictures, as long as Japan is occupied by Globo Homo, creepy Uncle Sam has military, but at some point in time, it's kind of like how Hungary bitches about the EU constantly. And you're thinking, why are y'all in there? You joined the EU, and I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand what Hungary's complaints are about the EU and the hypocrisy they point out and all of the rest of it. Those are legitimate criticisms. Hooray for Hungary. Hungary. I always want to say, like, I'm hungry. Cheers for them. But at the end of the day, you also often think, then why the hell? Why the hell are you in the EU? It's not like you don't know what it is. You join up with the European Clown World Union and then bitch about the European Clown World Union. Doesn't make any sense. See, this with a lot of the more Eastern European countries. They all wanted to be a part of the EU. Whether it's Poland or who else, they want to be a part of the EU. And then they bitch about immigrants. We don't want these immigrants and we don't want to do gay pride. It's like, dude, that's like literally what you're signing up for. I don't know. That would be like going to work for Payless and being like, I'm glad to have this job. I want to work at Payless, but I don't want to sell shoes. It's like, that's literally what they do. What the hell you mean you don't want to sell shoes? It's like going and applying for a job at Walmart and being like, I don't want to be a part of ignoring customers and being a wage slave. It's literally what they do. Ignore customers and be a wage slave. That illustration was funnier in my head than what it came out, by the way. They want to be a part of the EU, but they don't want immigrants and they don't want to do gay stuff. It's like, dude, you're signing up for immigrant gay global homo. It's called global homo for a reason. But now Japan and South Korea. They're just going to have more immigrants. You know, it's the answer. No matter what the question, you always get more immigrants. It's almost like there's a plan. You know, at some point in time, they're going to finally admit that the whole Great Replacement thing actually wasn't a crazy conspiracy theory. When they figure it's safe and it's too late for anybody to do anything about it anyway, they'll finally be like, well, you know how like we mocked people for years, calling them kooky, white supremacist, crazy conspiracy theorists, but that Great Replacement thing? Yeah, we actually did do that. You know, they do that. You know, like they invented that Gulf of Tonkin thing, you know, to start the Vietnam War. And then when enough years go by that it doesn't matter anyway, then they finally like, yeah, we made that shit up. Like nothing happened. Like we didn't even take a basic thing that happened and blow it out of proportion. We just pulled that straight out of our ass. But it's okay. The people that did it are dead now. So what difference does it make? But yeah, we lied to you. But trust us this time, bro. We're totally telling you the truth. I don't know. Societies change. And a part of it is the immigrants, but a part of it is, you know, we look at the society we live in now. And what I see, I think a lot of people have a hard time adjusting to, is you have people, and Japan's going to get, if they continue with more immigrants and all of the rest of it, and more gay stuff, whatever, that comes hand in hand, they're going to find out too. You get this clash when you have a high trust people. You're going to wind up, but you wind up living in a low trust society. You know? You got to make that adjustment. And I see a lot of the things we see is because you have a high trust people that generally tend to be high trust, but now you live in a low trust society. When you import low trust people, when you create a low trust society, people that tend towards being high trust are going to have a hard go of. They had that recent story about the woman from Ukraine, and she goes and plops down the subway. She never stopped to think, why is this seat empty? If people all standing around, you got this crazy homeless looking black dude sitting in this chair, and the seat right in front of him is open. And she goes and plops her ass down on the stairs at her phone. She forgot the number one safety rule, paid for it with her life. See, that's an extreme example of this. What happened? When high trust people are living in a low trust society, that seat was open because the other people understood, I ain't sitting by that guy. They won't say it out loud because then they'd be accused of being, you know, an evil, bad thinking racist. You know, it's kind of like years ago. You don't really hear it that much. Years ago, one of the criticisms, you know, of white people, they'd be like, black people would be like, oh, I see. Not all. You know, because like regular black people don't think about this shit. It's people that are working with a political angle. You know, regular black people really don't give a shit what white people are doing. They try to make you think they do, but they don't care. Much like you pretty much don't care what they're doing as long as it doesn't affect you. But you'd be like, oh, I'm walking down the street. I'm standing there waiting across the street. And this white person pulled up in the car and locked their doors. This bullshit story because the doors lock automatically when you take off in the car anyway. It's like a racism protection device. You don't have to get accused of racism by locking your doors because now the car does it automatically. You'd be like, well, I'd unlock the doors to prove I'm not a racist. But the car automatically locks the door. What are you going to do? But I remember years ago and there'd be a criticism of white people so paranoid about black people that they see you standing on the street corner and they lock their doors. The answer to that is, I wonder why. You know? Wonder why people in the Midwest, in an all white small town in the Midwest, they don't roll up and lock their doors because you got a high trust society, but you're getting a low trust society now. This is reflected in a lot of things. I was thinking the other day about this. And see, people, when you have high trust society, you don't have to have a bunch of rules because everybody acts neighborly, to put it away. You know, people use common sense. You can have common sense and neighborliness in a high trust society. You just assume people wouldn't do that. You know, for instance, where I live, I don't have any deed restrictions. I could put a hog farm in my backyard if I wanted to. Nobody could do shit about it because I don't have any deed restrictions. Now, I have no desire to do that. I don't want to smell pigs all day, you know. And even if I did, I wouldn't do that because that would be really a really shitty thing to do to my neighbors who would have to smell pigs all day. But there's nothing forcing me. There's no rule that says I can't do it. But you see, I wouldn't do it because I recognize that that would be a really bad, awful thing to do to my neighbors. You see, that's remnants of a high trust society. But because we live in a low trust society, people don't rely on that any longer. Even though their neighbors maybe wouldn't behave that way, it doesn't matter. They've got to have rules. You see, the lower the trust society, the more rules you got to have. Everything has to be legal. Everything has to be on paperwork. You can't do a deal by shaking hands. My gosh, if you don't have a written contract, that person may go back on their word. Because people in a low trust society, their integrity means nothing. For $20, they'll sell their integrity just to get you for $20. Everything's got to be legalized. Everything's got to have a rule. Everything's got to have a structure. You got to have it documented, notarized 3 times, 4 witnesses, and it has to be filed by an attorney. You can't trust nobody. It's low trust. You see, people can't trust their neighbor not to put a hog farm in their backyard, even though if you look at it, there's no way they would do that. They wouldn't even have the room to do it. Doesn't matter. They get this fearful idea. One of the great manifestations of the low trust society reliance on rules is the homeowners association. You see, you paid all this money to go live in a shitty development with all these houses stacked on top of each other, like 5 foot between each house, and you think you're somebody because you live 5 foot away in a nice new home. And it's fine. I'm not criticizing if that's the way you want to live. That's all well and good. But you see, your neighbor might do something. He might do something that you don't like. So you got to have the homeowners association. That guy could lower your property values. And of course, the homeowners associations always wind up with these just absurd and ludicrous rules, you know. You hear the stories about that guy hung an American flag off his front porch. That's against the rules of the homeowners association, and a big hubbub breaks out. People forgot to roll their garden hose up before sundown, and so they get a fine. They get a notice. Because the people who wind up being on the board or the president of the homeowners association are always those people that want to lord a crumb of power over somebody else. You got some busybody bitch out there with a tape measure seeing if your grass is over 1 inch high, because if it is, you're in violation of the rules. The homeowners association, you're going to be fined because you didn't cut your grass. And people justify it. You know, they justify it. That's all right, because if they let their grass grow up 2 feet high, it could lower my property values. Like, money is everything. It's crazy. Low trust society, high trust people, people who genetically tend towards being high trust, but they live in a low trust society. As a result of this, it's those higher trust people who are overly, this is one of the funny ironies about this. It's the people who would, under normal circumstances, in a normal society, who would be the higher trust people. Those are the ones that are going to beat you to death with the laws and the rules and the regulations. As an example of this, just to illustrate what I'm trying to say, you go out and you decide to build a new deck on your house. You go out there and you go buy the lumber. You're pretty handy with a skill saw, and you build you a deck. You're all proud of your deck. And then one day you get a knock on the door. There's a knock on the door. And it's some busybody bureaucrat from the county. We got a call. You built a deck out here. Did you build this deck? Or did you have it done by a contractor? Well, no, I did it myself. You know, I'm not helpless. I can do these things myself. I did this myself. But did you have a permit for this? What do you mean a permit? It's my property. I want to build a deck. I built a damn deck. Oh, no, 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 no. We got a call that you were out here building a deck without a permit. Now you're in trouble. So you're sitting around trying to figure out who could have. Who called me in? Who the hell is the kind of person that would call me in to the county and report me for building a damn deck of all things? I ain't cooking meth out here. Who turned me in? So you're looking around at your neighbors. You're looking up and down. You're looking at your neighbors trying to figure out who turned you into the county for building your own deck. Well, let's see. The black people that live across the street, they ain't turned you into the county. They don't give a shit. You know, I mean, that's truth. Your black neighbors, you can write them off unless you just have a bad relationship with them, like you got in a dispute over something. If they just your neighbors over there, I can assure you that in all likelihood, it was not the black people. Your Mexican neighbors, I can assure you they didn't call the county because you're building a deck without a permit. So now you're basically, you know... Assuming you don't have any Jewish neighbors, you're down to your white neighbors. And more than likely, the older they are, they probably turn. So you can narrow it down. If you have a somewhat diversified neighborhood, you start narrowing it down. It's not the Mexicans. They're not turning you in for building a deck. They're probably building one too. It's not the black neighbors. So you're down to the white, and you don't have any Jewish neighbors, so you're down to the white people. they turning you in. This is what happens. This is one of those weird ironies when you get people who, under normal circumstances, would be in a high-trust society, but you live in a low-trust society, and those people become just hyper-dependent upon rules. You did a good job on your deck. It didn't hurt anybody. But it don't matter. You're not following the rules. Morality, trust, common courtesy. They can't trust that their neighbor's not going to put a pig farm in their backyard because normal people wouldn't do that. They could do it, and that's enough. You see, normal people that come from a low-trust society, you know, they're able to function better. High-trust people just become so paranoid. You know, how the hell is never mind that the neighbor just has a small backyard with a privacy fence. They couldn't put pigs in there if they wanted to. It doesn't matter. The fact that they could, if there's not a rule about it and a regulation and someone they could report them to, the fact that they could potentially do it, that's enough. You see, when a high trust people live in a low trust society, then they trust you. Once it really sinks in, you have two levels. They're ridiculously naive and they plop down on the seat. What the hell are you doing on a subway to begin with? And then you plop down that seat in front of that guy. Or when they pass that naive stage, then they just become just almost paranoid. They got to have a rule. They got to have a governing authority. They got to have a board. They got to have a homeowners association. They need the police there 24/7. Then because somebody could do something. Never mind, they're not. They can't trust anybody. You see, when there comes a point when high trust people are in a low trust society, they reach this tipping point to where they go to the other extreme. They don't trust anybody at all. On anything, even though no matter how absurd the hypothetical situation might become, the fact that potentially, in theory, that person could do that, you know, they got a 20-foot by 20-foot backyard, but hypothetically, they could put pigs back there. Why they would do that, how that would be, it doesn't matter, doesn't play into it. There's not a rule. If there's not a rule against it, they could do it. And I'd have to smell pigs, and then I'd lose value in my ever holy property value. The holy grail of the value of my house. They got to have the rules. If they're not a rule, regulation, a legal document, an authority, a governing authority. And they clamor for more because they can't trust anybody. It's just like this weird extreme. If they can't live in a society where they can basically trust everybody, then they can't trust anybody. There's no middle ground. So it's kind of a really weird thing that you observe. There's no middle ground. They either can basically trust everybody, and so they can just la-da-da, go around their day. Or when they realize that's not the case, then they go to this other extreme where they don't trust anybody. And you wind up with this demand for more rules. Everything has to be legal. Everything has to be documented. Everything has to be covered by a law, a governing authority. And then they'll bitch about, you know, the government micromanaging our lives. And it's like, you just turned in your neighbor for building a deck. Why do you give a shit? I don't know. It's just one of them weird things. You know, observing how people be do. Crazy. But hey, we're looking at time. What isn't crazy is I'm looking at time. We need to go ahead and get off into the Christian specific segment. The train keeps on rolling. We're like the orange blossom special. Keep on rolling down the line. We got to keep rolling down the line and roll into the Christian specific segment. So you know what to do. As I say every week, get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. In the book of Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 28, Jesus said, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." I was asked about this verse, these verses, sometime back. And the older I get, the harder time I have remembering how long ago, you know, how long ago was some time. It could have been 2 months ago. It could have been 2 years. I can't hardly keep up. And at the time, I gave the best answer, as I understood it at the time, which was to just kind of sum it up. Basically, everything starts from somewhere. You know, if you look at somebody who does a really heinous, wicked thing, when just normally speaking, they don't just wake up one day and decide to do this heinous, wicked thing. You see, if you trace it back, it starts from somewhere. So it's basically viewing this as a seed from which you potentially do these things. And while I don't think that answer was necessarily incorrect, I do believe that answer, looking back on it now, was horribly incomplete. So I wanted to, I don't stop thinking about these things. We always got to think. Even when you think you find an answer to something, it's important to keep thinking about these things from time to time. And I wanted to go back and get back into this and give it some more context, because I do think there's a deeper meaning. And more importantly, I think there's an aspect of definitions here that's been somewhat kind of gets muddled in translation, gets lost in translation. And I wanted to go through this because when you run into these verses, what I have found is the average person's understanding of what's being said here is a little bit somewhat off base. Now, Jesus says here, if you look at a woman so as to lust after, you look at a woman and you lust after, you've already committed adultery in your heart. Now, I would be willing to bet 99% of the people that read that, myself included, at times, you know, well, if you look at a woman and, you know, damn, she looks good. You know, you've already committed adultery in your heart. There's a little bit of a problem with this, though, because basically you're probably committing adultery in your heart a lot. We're surrounded by imagery. We don't live in a normal society. I'll get to that here in a minute. I don't want to get ahead of myself. I believe if you look at this, and you step back and say, well, what does it mean when Jesus says to lust after a woman? You know, you lust after a woman. Because, again, most people, you look at that and you say, well, you look at her, you know, with lust in your heart, you know. But is that correct? What I mean by that is you can lust after a lot of things. A man can lust after money and it becomes his ruin. A man can lust after another's position. A man can lust after a new car. People lust after a lot of different things. And yet when we read this passage, we just assume it means physical sexual lust. You're lustful. You're wanting to have sex with that woman. You're looking at her, you think she looks good, and that goes through your head about, well, I bet that's good. But what do we? But we assume that because of the nature of what he's speaking about. But if, for instance, a man lusts after his neighbor's house, or a man lusts after more and more money in his bank account, we don't think, you know, he wants to roll up a bunch of hundreds and have sex with it. It's a different sort of lust. But what if it's what's being referred to here is not necessarily a different sort of lust? What if it's along the same lines of when we think about a man who lusts after money or another man's position? What if that's the same sort of lust, but it gets a little convoluted because we're talking about the subject of a man looking at a woman and lusting after her? And we naturally insert the idea of sexual lust. Obviously, that is implied here, but the two can run parallel. I think I'll make this make sense, so bear with me on it. Now, I will refer you, we're not reading it here because it would take too much time, and then I have enough problems not getting off track. But I'm just giving you the reference, which is 2 Samuel, the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 11. You're welcome to go read it. I encourage you to do so if you're not familiar with the story, but I would be willing to bet most of you are familiar with the story. The other reason why I'm not going to get into it. And this was David's lusting after Bathsheba, who was the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And again, I'm assuming most of y'all are familiar with the story. If you're not, like I say, it won't take you too long. You could pause here, go read 2 Samuel chapter 11 to see the problems David got into. I reference that, again, under the assumption y'all are familiar with the story, because this is an example of somebody lusting after a woman. Now, yes, sexual lust is a part of that, obviously. But there's a line that gets crossed when we're talking about lusting after her, lusting for her. So David is just, because I'm just doing kind of, you know, a summary referencing the story here. You know, David's hanging out at the palace or whatever, at the king's house. And he sees this woman down. He's up on the roof. He looks down. There's a woman's down there washing herself, I'm assuming at the well or the creek or whatever the hell. You know, and you know, he has that reaction. Damn, she looks good, man. Whew, she looks pretty good. So he's like, who's that? And he gets told that's Bathsheba. She's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, here's the line. Because you could have stopped there and been like, Uriah is a lucky dude, man. She fine. You know, she looks good. But he didn't stop there. He crosses that line. He lusted after. It was one thing for him to look and notice, she's fine. Dang, she looks good. But you see, it takes that next step for lusting after. He sins for her, and she comes to him, and he lays with her. The rest of the story gets even worse, of course, as she gets pregnant. Her husband is one of David's subordinates in the military, and he's off fighting in the latest war they're having that year. He goes through all sorts of lengths to try to cover up the fact that he's adulterized with this woman. And ultimately, those don't work, so he sets up a situation on the battlefield to make sure that her husband is killed. He basically has him murdered, indirectly, but he has him murdered to cover up what he's done. It's a great story if you're not familiar with it. Again, I assume you all are at least somewhat familiar with the story. But if you're not, you definitely should read it. I think it's one of the interesting things about the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, is that they don't sugarcoat these things. You know, it's not like when we get our own history and, you know, oh, this president that is, you know, painted in a positive light, any sort of skeletons in the closet, all that swept under the rug, and we always get the Disney version that he was a hero for freedom and democracy or whatever, you know, to make sure the world is a safer place or some nonsense. In the Bible, they tell the ugly stuff. They tell the ugly stuff, too, about the great leaders and kings and whatnot. Now, what this has to do with understanding what we started with, it was with Jesus' statement, is really narrowing down what it means to lust after a woman. Because here's the thing, and women, you're just going to have to bear with us because you're not going to understand this. Just like we as men, there are a lot of stuff y'all do, react to things that we will never understand about y'all. That just, people always like, we got to understand. Look, some stuff you just got to shrug your shoulders and say, there's just some things about the opposite sex, I'm never going to get it. I'm never going to understand it because I'm not them. And like women, this is one of those things as we go through, that you're not going to get it. The men are going to understand it. Trust me. I don't got to go into deep discussion and understanding. The men will be like, yeah, okay. Because with a man, just like with David, you look at a woman, and she looks good. You have that. You have just a reaction. You know, it's not a conscious thought. You just have this, oh, she's attractive. And it's like something clicks in your brain like, dang, she's fine. You know, I mean, it's just there. It's not, you know, hey, look at her. Let me study her for a minute. You know, she looks rather attractive. In fact, she would be a prime mating partner. That ain't how it works. A man looks at a woman and she's attractive and presents herself in a certain way. And there's this, I'm going to use that term. It's very base, but it'll serve the purpose for our discussion so we don't drag it out. You look at a woman, she look good, and dang. And it happens unconsciously. It does. Any man, unless you're old, I mean, the older you get, the kind of becomes more of a That's something you got to look forward to. You know, the older you get, the less you got. You know, when a young man just goes from one to the other. That's young men going through that all the time. As you get older, your becomes more of a So, but it's the point here is, it's an involuntary reaction. It really is. And if you define that base reaction as a conscious decision to lust after a woman, then you're constantly, near constantly, depending on the situation, obviously not constantly, but near constantly, on a regular basis, let's put it that way, on a regular basis, then you're quote unquote lusting after a woman, committing adultery in your heart. But I don't believe that's anywhere near correct, because that unconscious reaction is just simply your very base animal-like nature telling you to reproduce. Things you can look at rationally the older you get, you know, why you have that, you know, why do you have that base animal urge that drives you to reproduce? And the answer is simple, because if you didn't, you never would reproduce. You really wouldn't. You have to have that. We wouldn't exist as a species. And women be like, all men ever think about is one thing. And that's not all men ever think about. Well, like I say, young men, yeah, that's like 80% of what they think about. But it's not all men think about a lot of other things. That's how society gets built. That's how new designs come out. New ideas happen because men are thinking about other things besides that. But the reason that men have that instinct, you know, that desire that pushes them, which ultimately leads to reproduction, is because, again, if it was just something you made a rational decision to do, you know, the actual act of reproducing, when you remove that animalistic urge to procreate. When if you remove that, it's pretty gross. No, seriously, y'all chuckle at that. But when you really think of what's involved, like if you didn't ever, like there's no ever desire that drives you to do it, you know, that getting all worked up and all that goes with that. If it didn't exist and you're going about your life, you know, you're thinking about what you're going to do, you're building your business, you're whatever you're doing, you know, studying philosophy and understanding the truth, wisdom, and the nature of the world around us. And you're so interested in these things. And then, you know, you're like, well, let's see, I'm getting around that age. I need to start thinking about if I want to have children. So now you have to set aside the things you're interested in, take on a woman, and you have to do what? I've got to put what, where, and all of the, you know, everything that goes with it. I'm not going to get graphic. You get the point. If you didn't have that urge driving you, most people wouldn't do it. We got a lot better other things to do. Like the old joke where women complain about, that's all men ever think about. It's like, y'all would be glad that's what men think about a lot of times. Because if we didn't, if men didn't have that urge, y'all would be obsolete. Because you have to have an irrational drive to deal with all that goes with that. I'm in danger of getting way off track, reeling this back in. If you define that reaction that you just automatically are going to have, then you're going to be looking at yourself as constantly being in violation of what Jesus points out here. And that can be a problem. You know, that's a problem if you think that you're constantly committing one of the most dreadful sins, adultery. And it's one of the reasons it is a deadly sin, so as to speak. One of the reasons it is such a sin that was dealt with harsh punishment in the Bible is, again, exampled in our story in 2 Samuel of what happened with King David. He literally was cucking Uriah the Hittite. You know, the problem was Uriah the Hittite wasn't around, and when he came back from war and she's given birth to a child, there's going to be no question that he's been cucked and somebody getting put to death, and the king himself is not above God's law here. So there's all kinds of problems here. But if you're going around constantly thinking you're guilty of one of this horrible sin because you're having a normal reaction and you think you're lusting after a woman in your heart, it's not being correct. Now, I started to get into this earlier and I said I wanted to hold off on it because I didn't want to get ahead of myself. This is important because, once again, we have to remember, I believe, we don't live in a normal society. What we live in now, this is not normal. And, you know, people really don't understand that. I think, you know, people in general in the West and America, they don't understand how abnormal. If you went back just a couple hundred years and look at the way people live, no, it's not going to be identical. But if you took people, your own people, our own people, from say 200 years ago, and their attitudes towards things, the way they dressed, the way they behaved, it's closer to, say, the Taliban than what we have today. I'm not saying it's the same as. I don't know why we have to point that out, because I'm like, oh, it's the Taliban. No, it's not. But if you looked at where they were and their attitudes about these things, then it would be closer to, on a scale, it's closer to something like the Taliban than, or Iran, or an Islamic Republic, than this clown world, whatever the hell shit show we've got going here today in the modern world. We don't live in a normal society. We don't live under normal circumstances. And you get in trouble when you start trying to pretend that it is. Like, this is normal, and so we're applying certain things to this abnormal situation. In other words, let's put it a different way. In an Islamic society, there's going to be a lot less lusting after women, because as part of the culture, they're covered up. They're covered up. And people criticize that. And we're doing the Christian specific segment, and I sound like I'm promoting Islam. I'm not. But, you know, people criticize I was so oppressive to women. That whole covering up thing is partially to protect them. You know, that's actually, that's being done for their own benefit. You cannot, you're not, I don't care what you do, you're not going to get rid of that instinct that you have as a man. You're not. Now, so what this means is you're going to be constantly bombarded about this. You pull up the computer, for instance, to read a news story, and there's going to be an ad pop up, you know, it doesn't matter what they're advertising. They can be advertising a car. They can be advertising sexy singles in your area. It doesn't matter. They can be advertising butter or some shit. It doesn't matter. Probably 70% of the time, there's going to be a picture of an attractive woman to push this to you. And she's going to be showing herself off to an extent. And to an extent, as a man, you're going to have a certain amount of that reaction. You go to town. You go to the most innocuous places. You think you're just going down here to buy a loaf of bread or whatever, and you're liable to run into a woman dressed inappropriately. It is what it is. Whether she's wearing, you know, showing a lot of skin, whether she's wearing those ridiculous pants that women try to claim, oh, we made this because it's comfortable. Ain't nothing that damn stretchy and tight, comfortable. You tell yourself that all you want to, but you're not fooling anybody. Got the cleavage hanging out. Turn on the news. You're going to have some woman probably talking to you, smiling, showing her cleavage on the TV. The point here is that's not normal, and you're constantly going to be hit with that reaction as a man. Again, women don't get this. Men are sitting here. You got to nod your head. This ain't time for virtue signal. Oh, not me. I don't have that at all. Well, either, you know, you're a little different, or it's the norm. Anyway, before I started this, I thought I'm going to have to work really hard on this to keep things on track, because it's going to be so easy to get off into too many other things here, which, granted, that is kind of a normal thing, but this discussion even more so. If you're going around thinking you're constantly committing adultery in your heart just because of that, then that's going to get discouraging pretty fast. It's going to make you feel like you're really failing in your spiritual life. But going back to what we very first started discussing here, if you can lust after money, cars, houses, all sorts of different things you can lust after, and all of that lusting after also is a sin, then is it correct when Jesus talked about lusting after a woman in your heart to just simply put a simplistic physical lust to that? Or is it reasonable to say the same definition of lusting after, whether it's money, cars, house, whatever, also applies here to the woman? If we look at King David in 2 Samuel, the fact that he looked down there and saw this woman and was like, she's fine. Had he committed adultery, or was he lusting after her in his heart? Well, we quickly get the answer. He gets told that's Uriah the Hittite's wife. And instead of leaving it at that, he took it another step further. Let's really bear down on what this means. I believe a simple way to understand the difference of just simply having that reaction. And again, you got to be careful of that reaction, because it leads to the next step. That's like the starting point. You recognize it, and you got to get it in. You got to make sure you keep it in check. You stay in control all the time. This is the line so often on what makes something a sin and not, whether it's money or whatever. And I probably will circle back to that. I want to keep rolling with this, though. The easiest way, I think, a simple way to think of it is there's a, whatever it is, if it's a woman or money, a car, whatever, you're crossing that line into lusting after it. Could be, you cross that line, if you can sum it up with, I've got to have it. I've got to have it. It doesn't matter. It don't matter what it costs. It don't matter what the consequences are. I've got to have it no matter what. You know, you're looking at that new car. You know you can't afford it. You know you can't afford it. And it doesn't matter. I got to have it. It doesn't matter, man. I look at that, that's a nice car. I got to have it. I got to have it. When your attitude makes that shift to, I've got to have it, and it don't matter, I can't afford it, I don't care, I got to have it. Now you're lusting after it, and now you've crossed that line. Again, we have to recognize this, because crossing that line, we can delude ourselves into thinking we're not crossing that line, justifying what we're doing, when deep down inside, you know what you're up to. Let's stay on this and apply it now, a King David sort of situation, because you're not the king. You have to understand, the king, he calls for a woman to come to him. You know, I mean, she's going to go. You know, he's the king. He basically could walk through. And it's not like David wasn't getting any action. He had a huge harem. I mean, he had a bunch of wives. So it's not like, you know, but he wanted that one. Had to have it. Let's apply this to a hypothetical situation today. You live in somewhere, you know, and you got a neighbor, and you go talk to your neighbor every so often. And one of the things you notice right away, whenever you happen to run into your neighbor where your fence is or something, you know, next door, one of the things you notice right away, his wife got it going on. You know, she looked good. And you might tell yourself, I'll tell you what, Bob's old lady, he lucky, man. She looks good. You know, it probably don't help, because more than likely, Bob's old lady, she knows she looks good, and she like to wear them skin-tight clothes or low-cut shirt. Titties half hanging out. And, you know, you think about it, but now here's your choice. You got to make sure you keep that in check. Because what happens and Bob's out of town for a week or two or over the weekend, business, and you're out in the yard and you run into Bob's wife over there by the fence. So you go over there and start talking to her, and you're like, you know, what's going on? Oh, yeah, you know, where's Bob at? Well, you know, he's out of town for business for a week. And then you like, oh, wow, you know, well, hey, if you need anything, you know, while Bob's gone, you know, if you need anything, you let me know, you know. In fact, you know, what are you doing for supper? Because I got some steaks and I got an extra and I can grill these steaks. You know, we might could have a few drinks and a steak. Now, you can sit there and justify in your head, and you're telling yourself, I'm just being a neighborly. And I say, you know good and damn well what you're doing. Deep down, You know good and well what the hell you're doing. You ain't got no business inviting Bob's old lady to have a steak and a few drinks. You know what you're doing. You're trying to set up a situation. And that then people, if it goes too far, then and they get caught, and then people be like, it was an accident. I never intended bullshit. You see, this is what it looks like to transition from, dang, she shouldn't go out in the yard dressed like that. She shouldn't go anywhere dressed like that. It's crazy. To, you know, so, yeah, you know, I mean, like, you know, come over here. Now, maybe Bob's old lady says, oh, no, thank you. I'm good, though. Thank you, you know. That doesn't absolve the fact that you had an intention there. See, you already committed it in your heart. Because once you cross that line and started taking action to try to maybe something could happen here. See, you can give a shit. What are you inviting Bob's old lady for? Was she going to have some great conversation or some shit? She ain't got nothing to say. Not nothing any man's going to be interested in hearing. She's going to be rambling on, and you're going to be sitting there looking at them titties. That's all you doing. So you're taking action now. See, now because you're already adopting that, I got to have it mindset. I got to have it. Bob, man, this could cause all sorts of problems at your neighbor. Maybe you're on friendly terms. You know it ain't right. Maybe you married yourself and your wife are back at her mother's house. Whatever the case, you know it ain't right, but you're doing it anyway. Why? Because you got it. Something inside you says, I got to have it. It doesn't matter at this point that when you start trying to maybe set something up, again, your BS justifications of, oh, well, no, I'm just being neighborly. Bullshit. You know what you're doing. You're taking action trying to make something maybe happen, and, you know, that's because now you've crossing that line into, I got to have it. Now you're making irrational decisions. You know, the consequences, if it did happen, are not going to be worth the momentary pleasure, but it doesn't matter. Now you've crossed that line, you lost control, you got to have it. You're starting to take concrete actions to try to set it up because you ain't King David. You can't just say, bitch, get over here and get in my bed. You ain't the king. You got to try to do a little song and dance. See if you can woo her a little bit, pretending to be neighborly. And then again, even if she said, oh, no, thank you. You know, no, I'm good. I got to go now. And shoot your ass down. You ought to be grateful, by the way. Man in that situation wind up being offended and embarrassed. But if you think about it rationally, you ought to go back inside and slap yourself and be like, you know what? She did me a favor. What the hell was I thinking? Even though she shot you down, you already did it in your heart because you let yourself get into that, I gotta have it, mindset. It's funny because when you think about it, a lot of the things that cross the line into being sin are things that when they get mastery or control over you. Money is a perfect example. You know, everybody talk about money, the root of all evil. Or some people say, you know, the love of money. But you can't love money. How do you love money? It's an inanimate object. It's lust. You see, you lust after money. It's when you got to have it. It doesn't matter. You got to have it. You see these people, you know, and they're rich. You know, rich, powerful people. And they'll bend over backwards to steal somebody's last $20 bill or something and feel like they did something. And they got more money than they know what to do with. Why is that? It's like madness because they're lusting after it. It's not the love of money. It's the lust of money. They got to have it. Doesn't matter how much they've got. Just like King David here. He had hundreds of wives. And it didn't matter. That one, he had to have it. Had to have it. Doesn't matter what the cost. Got to have it. People talk about, you know, money being, you know, talking about in the Bible and money being evil. But the Bible also says money is the answer to all things. It's not a contradiction. It's a matter of perspective. You've got to have money to carry on, to have the things you need in your life, to buy food, to have shelter. You're going to have money. It doesn't make money evil. Money becomes sinful and an evil when you lust after it. When you, money, as long as money is your servant, I'm a little off topic, but I'm also not, because it's the same thing. It's just a different topic without adding the sexual lust element to it. It's still lusting after it. And I think this is the type of lust that Jesus is referring to, where we first started off in the book of Matthew. Money's not a problem as long as it's your servant, but it's always got to serve you. But it has a very strong tendency in people to get the relationship inverted, and men become in servitude to money. They lust after it. And it comes at people, and I've said this before, I've spoken about this before, but I think it bears repeating. One of the insidious things about lusting after money is it can come at you from both angles. For the rich man, it's his identity, you know, and he lusts for it, and he becomes a servant and a slave to it. But it also enslaves the poor man because of his lack thereof, because of its scarcity. For the rich man, he becomes enslaved to money because of its abundance. For the poor man, he can become enslaved to money because of its scarcity. You talk to a poor people, and they're always going to tell you what they do. It doesn't matter what their problems are in their life. Their answer is, if I only had money. because poor people, most of their problems do center around their scarcity when it comes to money. The scarcity of money. They're always the people like, if I won the lottery, my life would be heaven on earth. Boy, my life would be, it wouldn't. But they always believe it will. That person is just as enslaved to money, even though he doesn't have any, as the rich man. Money's fine, but it's always got to be in the role of serving you. It's just, you're the master, it's the servant. The Bible talks about zealous. It talks about being zealous. You know, it's great to be zealous for the Lord, but if you start becoming a servant to zealousness and your zealousness gets redirected to other places, it becomes a problem. Anyway, I think hopefully that kind of clears that up. I wanted to go back. I remember getting a listener supporter mailbag question about that and answering it. Like I said, and it's been some time back. And I don't think my answer was necessarily incorrect, but it was woefully incomplete. So I wanted to come circle back around and discuss it in more detail and really get down to the nuts and bolts of it. And hopefully we've successfully managed to do that today. It's time to wrap this show up. I appreciate you joining us. I always appreciate y'all tuning in, joining us this week. Dr. Johnson will be back tomorrow with his Orthodox Nationalist show, and he'll wrap up our week on Thursday with his installment of the Daily Nationalist. So I hope you enjoy the rest of the week. As always, I hope to see you back here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.